Welcome, members and guests, to the Australian Institute of International Affairs of Western Australia to this special event, this webinar. My name is Brendan Augustine, and I'm the president of the Institute here in Western Australia. We have the pleasure of organizing this particular webinar in conjunction with our sister organization, the AIIA of Tasmania. Before I go any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are assembling tonight and where I'm speaking from, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. I acknowledge the elders, past and present, as well as emerging. And I thank them for their leadership and custodianship of the land on which we are gathering tonight. We are very privileged tonight because we have two special guests who have given up their evening at various times to speak about this very contemporary topic about Malaysian politics. The Malaysian general election was held on the 19th of November 2022. And as most audience members will note, will recall, the election's results were quite unique in that for the first time in Malaysia's history, it delivered a hung parliament. That resulted in a few days of uncertainty, but after five or so days, Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, the leader of Pakatan Harapan, the coalition with the largest number of seats, was appointed Prime Minister. The journey to that was not clear, and we will go through that in our discussion with our two special guests. Let me introduce our special guests. Dr. James Chin, he's a Vice President of the Australian Institute of International Affairs of Tasmania, a professor at University of Tasmania, and a very frequent commentator both in Australia and overseas on contemporary Malaysian politics. We also have with us Mr. Jahaba Sadiq, who has been a journalist in Malaysia and in the region since about 1988. He is also, like James, a frequent commentator on Malaysian politics and politics of the region. Without further ado, let me start the discussion with the initial question. And just for the audience, can I note to you that the question and answer function of the Zoom webinar is turned on, and you are most welcome to type in your questions. We will have these discussions for about an hour, but your questions will be collated, and as moderator, I will group them together and pose them to our two guest speakers. And if during the conversation it is relevant to the topic that we are discussing at the time, I might introduce the question during the first part of the discussion. I will try to get through all the questions, and I'll give you enough time, particularly at the back end, to have a long and involved discussion with our two guest speakers. To set the scene, can I invite our two speakers to spend a few minutes, maybe 5 to 8 minutes each, providing us perhaps their 4 to 5 key main learnings from the results of the 19 November elections? What did the results tell us about the state of contemporary Malaysian politics? I will start first with Jahaba, and please after that, James, to follow on. Go ahead, please, Jahaba.
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me for this event. So I think, you know, the run-up to the elections was exceptional because it follows what happened in 2018. And subsequently, we elected the world's oldest prime minister. Or rather, the world's oldest prime minister became prime minister. And then he subsequently lost his mandate in within 23 months because members of his party decided to part ways with the other coalition partners. And we've had more prime ministers in 4 years than we ever had in 60 years, in that sense, right? Excuse me. So what has happened? What are the lessons we've learned from that was the elections were called in haste, in a sense that UMNO, the former and long-running linchpin of the government, decided to force an election because they wanted power themselves without sharing it with their erstwhile allies, Bersatu, and passed the Islamist Party. And so after a long roundabout way, we got the Prime Minister, Ismail Sabri, to actually dissolve Parliament and hold elections November 19th. Now, obviously, everyone expected that a snap election would favor UMNO because they were most prepared for it. Unfortunately, what we have learned from the election results on November 19th is very simple. That the one major electorate bank in Malaysia, the civil service, finally swung out from UMNO and decided to support Bersatu and PAS. And you could see the sweep in many rural seats, and more importantly, in the seat of the government in Putrajaya, the administrative capital, that seat, which was traditionally won by UMNO since its inception in 1998, went to Bersatu, went to a senator who was considered a no-hoper, a useless education minister, as it were, and he won. So the first thing, first point you can get out of this election was that the civil service abandoned UMNO and decided to stick in with Bersatu and PAS. And that's why you could see a sort of what they call a green wave that was very Islamist in nature, that won a lot of seats, won up to 74 seats in parliament. The second point was UMNO itself, being in the lead position, agitating for a general election, lost badly. They only won 36 seats. And for a simple reason, they did not have money. They didn't raise enough money, which they usually do. They are usually cash rich. They didn't have the machinery, which has slowly dissipated in the last few elections. In GE 14, in G13, since 2008, when Barisan Nasional, the coalition that UMNO leads, has been losing its majority and slowly losing its seats, right? So basically, people weren't investing in them, people weren't donating money to them, tycoons weren't giving them enough money. And of course, they tried a different way of raising funds, read the 1MDB scandal, where Prime Minister Najib found an alternative way of raising funds for the party. So that didn't work. He's in jail for that. They don't have the machinery anymore because the machinery depends on money. And they don't have the money, therefore, you don't have machinery. The other M, there's three M's here. The other M was they didn't have a mission. What was their mission? You know, in all the years that they were government, they've always talked about development. But in all the shenanigans since 2018, it was all more about power and keeping power for themselves. And they were getting a lot more parochial in nature. They were talking about Malay rights and how the Malays were losing out. A narrative which, you know, someone like the world's oldest Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, still agitates once in a while. The third point is that, you know, since Anwar was sacked in 1998 and jailed in 1999, his party, PKR itself, has always been more an urban party. And in the 20 odd years that the party's been existent since Anwar was sacked and jailed, it has never expanded its footprint beyond the urban areas. And I think there's been a bit sloth about it. I mean, the fact that that Nurul Aziza, his daughter, lost the family fortress, so to speak, in the last election, proved that they were just confident they could keep their things, right? They were nonchalant about, you know, making sure that they kept power and kept expanding their power. They didn't get to do that. And it just showed that maybe they needed a kick up their collective posterior, a lesson to actually do better, or also to draft in new candidates who would work the ground and get it for them. The last one I want to make was also the rise of Borneo parties in Sabah and Sarawak. these parties, as we've known, have always been dominated. I'm sure James will have a lot to say about this, by the chaps in the Malay Peninsula. But, you know, because of the pandemic and because of, I think, really steady, how do I say this, patriarchal leadership, especially in Sarawak, and of course, some infighting in Sabah, that the votes actually went to more local parties, more state-based parties than rather than the peninsula-based parties. And it just tells you that Malaysia, as we stand today, is ever more divided politically. I mean, I think as a nation, as peoples of a nation, we are quite united being Malaysian, as you could see from the reception for Michelle Yeoh when she won the Oscar. But as people, we are. But I think politically, and I think it's because politicians need to divide to rule, to show that they're different from the other and they're better, you will have political divisions going in for the longest time going forward in our country. And until one day, I think a new generation of Malaysians will say, look, hang on a minute, let's push this aside and let's really build a Malaysian narrative rather than a narrative based on race or region and religion, so to speak. So that's
that. Thanks. Thanks, Jahaba. I was trying to find a way to bring Michelle Yeoh into the conversations. Thank you for doing that for me. And the point you made about UMNO, sometimes people don't understand that not only did it had leading up to 2018, had it won every election since independence in 1957, but it goes back to the colonial times when the first legislative assembly and councils were formed in the early 50s. The Alliance Party had won every election. So this is the last 5-6 years, you've seen really a seismic shift in politics in Malaysia. So James, maybe your reflections on that seismic shift and you know, particularly how it played out in November 2022.
Thank you very much. I'll start off by thanking AIIA Western Australia for the kind invitation to hold this joint event. So I think very quickly, just to add on to what Jahaba has said, I'd like to make about 8 or 9 points. I think the first point about this election is that the Malay polity, the so-called Malay voters, were really split in these elections. So in 2018, you can see that the votes were split 3 ways, but in this election, it was essentially split only 2 ways. It was basically between Perikatan Nasional or UMNO. The second point I would like to make was that for a very long time, the NGOs in Malaysia or the CSO were agitating for what they call the U18 votes or the new voters. Put everybody, make sure you have automatic registration. One of the interesting things was that the underlying assumption was that with young people, they tend to be more progressive, so they will vote for more progressive parties. But in fact, that didn't turn out to be true. The sort of figures...
Just a point, James, for our viewers. So this is the first time that voting age was 18 in this election.
Yes. And also automatic registration. Whoever is above 18 years old, your name will appear in the electoral roll, regardless of whether you sign up for it or not. So based on the figures I've seen, especially in the Malay heartland states, a lot of the 18, 19, 20-year-old, or what we call the first-time voters, they actually came out, and when they came out to vote, they actually voted for Perikatan Nasional. So that's the second point. The third point is something that both of you are alerted to, that this is the first time that the electoral system in Malaysia were not able to return a clear winner. As you all know, right, one of the reasons why we have first passed the post system was that it's supposed to return a very clear winner. But in this case, very first time, no clear winners at all. And it was not even close. I mean, the magic number was 112, and the closest we got was just above 80. So it was not even close. The fourth point I'd like to make is that for the very first time in the last 3 or 4 elections, Sabah and Sarawak are no longer the kingmakers. In fact, the kingmaker this time turned out to be UMNO, right? And the fifth is that for the very first time as well in Malaysia's political history, the royals had to come in to select the winner, so to speak. So they had to intervene directly. So I think that is a really, really important point because we're dealing with constitutional issues here. The sixth point I'd like to make is that I think after last November's election, it is now normal to have regime change. Prior to 2018, right, I was speaking to a lot of senior people in Kuala Lumpur. Everyone was saying that if there's a regime change, you don't know how the army is going to behave. You don't know how the civil service is going to behave. But now after three or four regime change, especially in 2018, 2020, 2021, and now 2022, nobody even talks about, you know, a threat to the whole nation if there's a regime change. In fact, it is seen as normal. And yet this thing has happened only in the last 5 years. The other point I want to make is that the gulf between, not only between the politics are huge, the gulf between Peninsula Malaysia politics and East Malaysia has gotten even wider. But the thing that really worries me is this very important point I need to reiterate. If you look at the Malaysian parliament now, right, the two biggest bloc is PAS and the second biggest bloc is DAP. And these two have nothing in common at all. There is no overlap. Right, one stands for overthrowing the current constitution, wanting to set up a theocratic state. The other stands for liberal secular state. So there's nothing in common between these two big blocs, and they are the largest blocs in parliament, basically accounting for about half of all the seats in parliament. And finally, the interesting point about this election was that the federal government, or whoever's in the federal government, in this case Pakatan Harapan, they will have a chance to retest, you know, the theory about the green wave, because later on this year, we will see six state elections coming up. And out of these six state elections, three will be what they call the Malay heartland states. So we will know for sure whether there was such a thing as a green wave that happened last November. Thank you.
Thanks, James. I'll come back to those very interesting 5 days and as political tragics, I know we were stuck. I think you were in Malaysia at the time, James. Of course, Jahaba, you were there. I was stuck to the internet, trying to figure out all the moves and the slaloming between one party and the other and individuals. So we've made the point. Hung Parliament. Anwar led Pakatan Harapan, won the largest single bloc, as you said, not by much. His accession to Prime Minister on 24th November was a complicated and chaotic process, requiring him jumping into bed with some strange partners. I would like to unpack these five dramatic days. Maybe you can share, James. I'll start with you now. What chances did you give Anwar when you saw the results and the permutations and the calibration required, both from a policy and a numbers perspective, to make that magic number? And you mentioned the role of the royals. Maybe if you can unpack that, James, and then your views after that, Jahaba.
Yeah, I think if you look at the 5 days, you've got to divide the first 24 hours, the night the election results came out, and then 2 days after that. I think when the results came out, it was quite clear among a lot of people in Kuala Lumpur that Perikatan Nasional was in the lead, because Perikatan Nasional was quite gung-ho. Muhyiddin thought that he can swing UMNO behind him, but more importantly, he already had a phone call with GPS, the ruling coalition in Sarawak, and they actually flew people over to say that they will join Perikatan. So I think it was quite gung-ho about it. But what happened with the Palace was that the Palace gave everybody at 2 o'clock the next day to formally submit a list. And I think what happened was that there was a lot of back and forth. And 2 days later, I think this is, of course, we will never know because the palace is not going to confirm any version of it. What I suspect happened and what people tell me was that basically there was sort of a meetings of individual political groups and political leaders with the Agong. And I think there was some sort of conversation. I think the conversations, although the Agong did not tell them exactly how to go about the government, but I think there was a lot of hint on both sides about which way the wind should be blowing. And I think after the second day, I think it was quite clear that the palace wanted a government that reflect the Malaysian reality, which is a multicultural and a multi-religious society. I think one very important point is that if you look at Perikatan Nasional, right, even on election night, it was very clear they had not a single Indian or Chinese MP elected. I think that bothered a lot of people, especially in the so-called Malaysian establishment. It was always understood that, you know, if you want political stability in Malaysia, every community or every major community has to be represented at a high table. Of course, I'm not saying that everyone has equal power, but everyone is represented at a high table. And I think that thing sort of bothered the Malaysian establishment. So my take is that, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, there were hints given out that, you know, probably Anwar can pull together a better government that reflects, you know, the diverse society Malaysia is. But again, like I said, we will never know the true story. But whatever deal that was done, the crucial deal was basically two things that happened that gave Anwar the numbers to form the government. That was the role played by Zahid. He really cobbled UMNO together, even though he faced lots of opposition in UMNO. He basically put his foot down, so to speak, even though he knew that, you know, he still got corruption cases against him. He wanted to pull across to Anwar. And secondly, the big thing that happened was that GPS had to retract the support for Perikatan Nasional because the non-Muslim community in Sarawak put up a big fight. And basically, they told GPS that we cannot accept you supporting, you know, an old Malay government, especially when it's quite clear that Perikatan Nasional only represents one segment of the population and does not reflect the true diversity of Malaysia.
I want to unpick that a little bit. And I followed that story of the protests in Sarawak. So in your view, it played a role in switching GPS, the premier party in Sarawak, to change its alliance.
It was one of the major pressure points because for the very first time, the Anglican Bishop of Kuching came out with a very, very strong statement. And that was supported by the Catholic Bishop. And it was also supported by all the churches in Sarawak. So I think that was a really important thing because traditionally the churches in Sabah and Sarawak tend to be non-political or they don't show their political hand. This time they came out openly. They even issued a press release. That was very, very unusual. And that brought a lot of pressure on the GPS to at the very least, reevaluate their support for PN. But like I said, it is my understanding that, you know, they also received hints from the palace that maybe their first choice wasn't going to work out well.
Thank you. Jahaba, over to you. And maybe I would like you to reflect as well, and we can come back to it if there's interest in the Q&A with the audience, is the role of the palace. The Agong is the king in Malaysia. It's a rolling five-year term between nine traditional rulers of states. Just for our audience who's not so up to date with the Malaysian constitutional systems. So the role of the palace in those 5 days, Jahaba, unusual, but important. What does this say for the future as well? And if you want to reflect on that as well in your comments.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that. Definitely, it's unusual. I mean, we are a constitutional monarchy. Usually, there will be enough of a majority for someone to submit to the palace after elections that they would like to form the government. They have enough support in parliament to form the government. But as James pointed out, this was the most hung parliaments in Malaysia. And notwithstanding UMNO, by the skin of their teeth, of Barisan Nasional, having fewer than 40 seats, in Zahid's eyes, would support Anwar Ibrahim. But in the eyes of his own MPs, newly elected MPs, they were more keen to swing towards Perikatan. So you had a situation where individual MPs were torn. But they had to hold on to the fact that we had this new anti-hopping law. So they had to go as a bloc. And I think the nine rulers, particularly the king, reflected on this and decided to take charge of a situation which is really unprecedented in Malaysia. You know, in the sense that after a general election, the palace basically nudges everyone and says, I'd like this chap to be the prime minister. Never done before in Malaysia. Now, of course, it was done in a slightly more oblique way in 2020 when Muhyiddin Yassin himself became prime minister because Dr. Mahathir Mohamad had resigned. And then subsequently, Ismail Sabri took over from Muhyiddin Yassin. Those were very subtle ways of arranging who should be prime minister, but that was done without an election. This is the first time in an election, after an election. I mean, imagine this, right? A country of X number of voters returned 222 MPs. And yet, it took the palace to tell them who the prime minister should be. I can't say that's really a democracy. But we live in interesting times. And in many ways, I think more Malaysians thank the palace for their wisdom in choosing the government of the day. And as James has pointed out, a government that reflects Malaysia, the establishment, the general population, the peoples of Borneo states and the Malay states, Peninsula Malay states, a lot more representative than the other side, so to speak. But you know, it comes with an issue going forward. Will we always see this? As James pointed out, regime change is now a regular thing in Malaysia. But does this mean that every election we will look towards the palace? And it is, as you pointed out, it's a revolving term, right? Every 5 years, we get a new king. So are we then exposed to the vagaries of who the king is and who his preferences are? And so that's troubling. That is troubling for Malaysia. That's troubling for democracy, so to speak. And unless we fix our electoral system, maybe no longer a first past the post, maybe the other hybrid systems we can talk about. But this is actually troubling, troubling to anyone who's a voter in Malaysia, where one man has one vote. Now, of course, we've never had one man, one vote in Malaysia because of the gerrymandering. And James also pointed out, you have two extreme blocks, DAP with 40 over seats, PAS officially with 49 seats, but 49 seats with X number of voters against the DAP held seats, which has, I think, maybe twice the number of voters. Sharizan, who won in Serdang, he's standing in a constituency of 300,000 voters, right? And we have seats which are so small. I think they're probably like 1/6 of what Serdang is, right? So we in 2026, in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time, we will be starting the redelineation of our constituencies. Maybe there'll be a balance. I don't know. I think James will be perfect to actually tell you that our constitution actually says 1/3 of the seats should actually be outside the peninsula when Singapore was part of us. And then I think it changed in 74, if I'm not mistaken. And now there's some sort of guarantee 1/4 of the seats are outside of the peninsula. Now, how does that help us? I don't know. But if you need a balance of seats, so then you can actually have a clearer outcome of elections. But what has happened in the 5 days from 19 to the 24th, when Anwar Ibrahim became Prime Minister, is troubling because we had to rely on one man in the palace to basically say, please go this way. And I do not think any democracy should actually have that kind of power given to one man. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something new, another new element in Malaysian politics. You touched on the gerrymandering. It's, you know, I thought Malaysia was the world champion of gerrymandering, and then I discovered the US electoral system. So I think Malaysia is still not the world champion. Like, you know, Malaysia's never won an Olympic gold medal, so it's still silver. The issue with there's an Australian connection to that constitutional protection, because in the original 1957 constitution, there was protections of relative sizes, as we do in the Australian constitution. But that was taken away in the 1960s, because in Malaysia, you only need 2/3 majority in the lower house in parliament to be able to change the constitution. So that protection was also removed, leading to what we have today in that heavily gerrymandered system that you have. But one positive, I think both in the 2018 and the 2022 election, I would see as an outsider, as an observer, is the performance of the Electoral Commission, the SPC, SP, I don't know the Malay acronym, I keep forgetting.
SPR.
SPR. You know, I think that's a stamp of legitimacy that they've been able to establish through various administrations through the regime change. So I think that augurs well for the future of Malaysia's democracy from that perspective. I don't know whether you'd agree with me on that or not.
Oh yeah, I think what we have is actually a very good set of people at the SPR. We've got two people of note, Zoe Randhawa, who used to be from Bursay, and Professor Azvi Sharum, UM Law Lecturer. He's the Deputy Chairman of the SPR. I think without them in the Election Commission, we would actually go back to Najib's last election in 2018, where we had voting day, balloting day was on a midweek in Wednesday, on Wednesday, rather than the traditional Saturday. And I think we were fortunate now that we have established, I think, at least 9 days of campaigning rather than, you know, that was 2 weeks of campaigning rather than the the shortest, which is 9 days. Yeah.
Great. Moving on, and James, I'll turn to you for this. And again, I hasten back to my childhood when I was growing up and following politics from a fairly young age. I wouldn't have imagined that one day I would see UMNO and DAP in a governing coalition. If somebody told me that, I would have told you were seriously under the influence. For political scientists, so many of the normal idioms could apply. Politics is the art of the possible. There are no permanent friends or enemies in politics, etc. Prior to the deal being struck, would you have thought it possible, James?
I think for those people who have been watching Malaysian politics since 2018, it was quite clear, especially at the state level, that the UMNO people suddenly found PAS being too difficult to deal with. I've been told many times by UMNO people that, you know, on the surface, it looks like we have a lot in common, but at the grassroots level, we really have problems with the PAS people. I think the key to it is really they found that the DAP were very businesslike. And for whatever reasons, they sort of caught on to that, especially in places like Perak. Basically, the idea was that they caught on to this idea that we don't have to agree anything. We just agree on a set of things that we want to do. We form the government, just do those things, but we do it the way, you know, each of us, whichever party represents, we do it through our own individual parties. There's good and bad things about that approach. But basically, I think, basically with UMNO, the thing that was driving them, including looking at dealing with DAP, is basically UMNO understood that, you know, as Jahabar said in his opening remarks, the only reason UMNO can survive is because they have access to government resources. Without access to government resources, right, they cannot survive. And that was the lesson learned in 2018 when they lost power. Suddenly, all their best friends disappeared. You know, as there's a saying that, you know, you only know who your real friends are after you no longer hold the office. And I think that was exactly what happened to UMNO. They realized that the only game in town is to be part of a government. And so that's the reason why they were willing to compromise. And I think on the other side, it was true as well. For the DAP, after being in government for the very first time in 2018, after losing government in 2020, they also realized that, you know, the only game in town is to be in government. We don't have to control the entire government, but we only have to be part of the government so that we can do certain things for the people we represent. And I think that was the thing that pulled both of them together.
Jahaba?
Yeah, I think, the premise for both UMNO and DAP is that they're not the other, right? UMNO is Malay, UMNO is about the king, UMNO is about patriotism, but UMNO is caught up according to the DAP, right? So the DAP says, no, we are all about for every Malaysian, not just the Malays. We want a liberal, equitable future for every Malaysian, notwithstanding their origins. So they've always played on that at every election they clash. But I mean, the reality is they don't actually stand against each other. You know, DAP is more urban seats, UMNO is more rural seats. But so in many ways, going forward in the next six state elections, they won't really be facing each other or giving each other seats. But what is troubling is that to their members who have been brought up to that the other side is the evil one. How do you reconcile cooperating or sitting or sleeping in the same bed as the federal government? Which is why you can see that the top leaders of the DAP are not in the federal government. Right, it's more the younger set of members, a bit more amiable, who have never put much stock in saying that we are not UMNO. The likes of Anthony Loke, Hannah Yeo, Now, they were always about Najib Razak and 1MDB, but not essentially UMNO is evil. But for UMNO, because UMNO has so few MPs, whoever is available is in the government. So they have to go back now to their voters in the state election and says, we can work together because. So there needs to be a new narrative. But I agree with you. You know, anyone growing up in Malaysia, I would say, this is impossible. I mean, if you go back, even dredging up the past of the Selangor elections in 1969, for example, and why you had emergency and all that. This is definitely a seismic change in Malaysia. But it also tells you that, as James said, you know, out of the possible, anything can happen, and it has happened. And so be prepared for more shocks along the way. But, you know, the one reality of this entire exercise is that race-based parties now have very little say and sway. You know, the likes of MC and MIC are not, their future is very much in doubt. And and so this one point I'm bringing up is because in the outset when you said the government did not have any non-Malays, they didn't have Indians and Chinese, James and you mentioned this. Actually, the MC and MIC chaps in the 5 days had wanted to be with Perikatan, right? But because Zaid won by the skin of his teeth, he said no. You know, so if you ever go back to that 5 days or even November 18 and 19, why UMNO lost so badly, at the end of it, UMNO itself was at cross purposes. There were people sabotaging each other. And I think the main point of that night, November 19 night, was they wanted Zahid to lose. Because if he had lost, you and I won't be here talking about Anwar Ibrahim as Prime Minister today. None three of us won't be here at all. We will be, we'll have Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin as in Putrajaya rather than facing 7 fraud charges.
Well made point. So Anwar led the Anwar led administration has just passed a couple of weeks ago its 100 days in power. James, if you were marking this student as a professor and giving them a progress report, what would it be?
I think all fairness, I'll probably give them a B. They won't get an A. I'll give them B for the following reasons. I think there are several things that came out that is very, very positive. One was the budget that came out. I think a lot of people thought that Anwar will go for election budget because of the 6 elections coming up. He didn't really do that. Although there were some elements like a lot of the direct cash benefits to the bottom 20, which is basically the poor Malays. But basically, there were no shiny, big shiny projects in the budget. And I think that was really important. It sort of calmed the international markets. Secondly, I think what was positive is that Anwar is very well known internationally. So I think the international community had a very positive outlook for Malaysia. Because as you know, they had a very negative outlook with Najib and the thing. I think what was also positive was that they did rush through several bills. So for example, you know, even though they didn't originate it, but they did push through the bill to give citizenship to children born to Malaysian mothers. Malaysia is very conservative. It is not the only Commonwealth country, but they inherited a law where it says that only if your father is a Malaysian, the children will get the citizenships. So they did push over there. But I thought the really important one was that they pushed through the bill, which granted Sabah and Sarawak status in that it mentioned the Malaysia agreement. This is a long-standing thing. They pushed that through. And the next bill, my understanding, they're going to try to push through, and that's really, really important as well, is that they're going to remove absolute power to the AG's position. They're going to split in two. That will be a real game changer in the judiciary. So for those reasons, I will say that they've done quite well to get a B grade. But of course, they've done some major political mistakes. One is, of course, Anwar should not have appointed the daughter as an advisor to the finance minister. I think that was handled very poorly. And also, I think some of the ministers in the current government are underperforming. But having said that, you have to remember this is a government, you know, that's only been in power for only 100 days. By and large, in terms of the image thing, as you know, in the 21st century government is about images and everything. I think by and large, he has not made any major mistakes. So it's a question of how will he carry on forward in this. My understanding is that the entire government machinery is sort of on hold because everyone is waiting for the results of these upcoming six state elections. So these six state elections is really crucial to the question we asked in this seminar, whether Arnaud will hang around to the end of the year or will he disappear at the end of the year. Everything hinges on the upcoming six state elections. And I think Jahabar may have something to say about that as well.
Just a couple of points to follow up questions. Can you explain a bit this AG change in the AG's role? And also, can you remind our audiences when the state elections are being held?
Right. So in terms of the AG, Malaysia has not inherited the Westminster system. So the way it was in Malaysia is that the AG has become a very politicized position. So the thing about the AG, the thing that people are really bothered is that the AG has absolute discretion on any sort of cases, whether he wants to prosecute
or not. Yeah.
Yeah, whether he wants to prosecute or even if he wants to drop it. So that's the reason why a lot of people said that if you have the government, your cases will sort of disappear, slow down, whatever. So the idea is that too much power is held by one person, and that person officially is a non-political person, but in practice it's a highly politicized post. So most people feel that you can't have a government going forward in this position. So it's crucial they split the position up. The idea is that you give prosecution power to another person. So I think that's really important. Now, in terms of the state elections, basically what happened was that the Malaysian system requires both the state and the federal government to hold elections every 5 years. So because the elections were held last year before the 5 years is up, these six states that were elected in 2018, they need to hold their elections this year. The unique thing about these six states is that two of these six states are so-called the most urbanized and the richest state in Malaysia, Selangor and Penang, which is also where the bulk of the non-Malays live, but also three of the what they call the Malay heartland states, Kedah, Terengganu, and Kelantan. And the reason why it's very important is something I mentioned in my opening remarks, that the so-called green wave happened in these so-called Malay heartland states. Because traditionally, it was always understood that past political power was locked into the four heartland states in the north. They were not able to break out. So people are saying, is this breakout real? Or people supported PAS because they hate UMNO. They want to get rid of Zahid and Najib. So we will know the answer when this six state election comes out. As to the timing, although they haven't officially announced the results yet, it is almost certain to be held after Hari Raya, where everyone is happy. And the sort of dates that people are talking about now, you can't hold me to it, but people are just saying it, it's either July or August.
Thank you. Thank you. And Jahaba, I know you have reported from close distances political transitions in the region, notably in Indonesia. I think we were both in Jakarta during the Suharto transition, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And so you've seen these political transitions take place. How has Anwar and his coalition partners managed it, especially given that the 2018, the 2 years, around about 2 years, the 18 months they were in power, and now this time around?
Well, I think there's a huge difference, really. I would like to call it 2018 government's PH1, the 2022 government's PH2. And the difference is because most of the personalities in this current government were not in the Mahathir government. So they have different ways of working or engaging or problem solving. And also you have to remember that the current government is actually a coalition government that is beyond PH, that's beyond Anwar's coterie of parties. It involves the Sarawak parties who were so much against him previously when he kept saying that he had the numbers. I mean, remember when he said he had strong, formidable, convincing numbers, and that became a sort of a joke. But yeah, so you have a government where he has put in people, or he's been asked to name people that he was never comfortable with, who are also not comfortable with him. So I agree with James that, this just means, you're sort of past it. I mean, they're lacking in some policy issues. I think the first 100 days should be a lot more on policies, but policies will be slow because of the six state elections. They don't want to alarm people. You can also see that they didn't do, unlike Dr. Mahathir, they didn't change around a lot of civil servants. The chief secretary of government is still the same chap. The IGP is still the same chap. The anti-corruption guy is the same chap. The attorney general is the same chap. He has not sacked anyone. He has not shamed anyone. It's just a bit of a charm offensive. So I think the first 100 days was about letting people be comfortable with him. I mean, this is a guy who has been wanting to be prime minister for a long time and got it after almost 25 years of being in the wilderness, right? So I'm sure he'll take it very slowly, very measured ways. So I think we only know more what this government is all about after the six state elections. So we are still in a holding pattern. They still have made mistakes, as James pointed out, appointing Nurul Izzah to an advisory post. And I get it. I get why he did that. Because I think this time around, really, he has very few people he can trust. I think you can see from the groups that he has, the people that has put in place, these are the people he trusted from 30 years ago. Not some of the younger advisors who came along when he was in jail, out of jail. I mean, Anwar is known for changing his circle of advisors every 5-6 years, but he's putting in people that he can really trust from a long, long time ago. So it'll be slow and he will make mistakes. And more so if he appoints family members or anyone else like that. I think we hold him to a higher standard. We hold Anwar to a higher standard because we think he's a reformist, because he's been saying he's a reformist. He only became a reformist when he was sacked in 1998. So we're talking about, and the reform label, you know, came because of Indonesia. Yeah. Right, when you're there during the change, right, the KKN, corruption, cronisme, and nepotism, right? So this reformasi cry started in Indonesia. You know, we adopted it. He adapted it. So I think he's, when people say he's a reformist or has reformist credentials, I will say I have a long memory. I was a junior, I was a cadet journalist at the time. And I can still remember things. I said that the jury is still out on reforms, but I think he'll do it slowly. He has to. What has happened in the time he has been in jail and out of in the wilderness is we actually, and this is something we haven't never discussed, we discussed the royalty just now, is the role of the civil service. The civil service is a law unto itself, right? Notwithstanding all the governments that came in the last 4 or 5 years, the civil service has remained largely intact, with the same kind of mindset, and which is why some people are saying, alluding that there's a bit of a pushback by silly things like dress codes and such, right? So when we talk about a lousy government, sometimes, and when we talk about how things can be solved, some of those problems and solutions are actually at the civil service level, not at the political level. But we can't tell the difference because we are so used to making everything political in Malaysia. So it's something for us to ponder that maybe some of the things, the mistakes made, particularly in implementation of policies, is because the civil service is loath to do it or they don't see it as an advantage to them. And this has happened during the time when Najib was in prime minister, when he set up his Pemandu, his outside unit, his Blue Ocean strategy. He did all that because he knew the civil service wouldn't condone what he did, right? And I think, so that's one issue. I think for further talks, we really have to talk about the Malaysian civil service. I think they have been more an impediment than an encourager of good things going forward for Malaysia.
I think you made a very good point. I mean, in the material I'm seeing, as you referred to the charm offensive, there's so much material out there of, you know, Anwar at the public service, at the gatherings, you know, dynamic speakers like himself, like some of his ministers, like Hannah Yeoh, sort of, you know, praising the public service, encouraging them to be, you know, for want of a better word, you know, policy entrepreneurs and the like. So, and, you know, maybe that's a strategy that he and his team are trying to employ, is to shore up the support of the public service, empower them, and try and make it appear as if he's working into their best interests.
Yeah, definitely.
So we've started the crystal ball exercise, but I want to sort of formally start it now. You know, we have seen how strange this coalition appears to be. You know, we've talked around the issue of this magic number of 112, if I'm mistaken, 112, that he needs to maintain his majority in parliament. You've mentioned, both of you have mentioned the state elections. I want to, I guess, look at other issues that could impact on a split in the coalition. And I want to turn back to the DAP, I guess, James. It appears to be playing a very different role this time around. I think, Jahaba, you alluded to it. You saw a very brash DAP in 2018, you know, making, you know, some could even argue arrogant. They seem to have learned from that lesson, not just personnel, but their posture and the tone that they're taking appears to be quite different. How do you see it, James?
I think I would agree with you totally that the DAP that we see today is very different. And I think a lot of the credit has to be given to the new DAP Secretary General, Anthony Locke. I think Anthony Locke has a much wider appeal in the Malay community compared to Lim Guang Eng. I think what you saw in the DAP, and Anthony Locke has gone on record, he gave a very important media interview, and he said very clearly that, you know, after the elections, we made it very clear to Anwar that, you know, we will give him completely free hand in terms of putting the government together. Free hand including who he wants to appoint to cabinet, how many positions he wants to give to DAP. We're not going to demand anything. All we want is an Anwar-led government. So because of that, I think the DAP has made a deliberate decision to keep a very low profile, because they understood clearly one of the reasons that the 2020 Pakatan Harapan 1.0 government fell was because UMNO and PAS started a very, very successful campaign at that time. The narrative was that the Malays and Islam was being sidelined, and they blamed the DAP primarily for that situation. So that was also the reason why you can see very clearly that this time Anwar did not appoint DAP or any other party to hold the Minister of Finance post. He held it himself. And in fact, the second post, Minister of Economic Affairs, he also gave it to his own party. So you can see that, you know, he was quite clear about the way he structured the thing. The DAP basically got positions that were regarded as not to say not political, but less politically risky, things like transport. So when you talk about transport in Malaysia, right, the thing that comes to people's mind is all about the delays with AirAsia, difficulty in getting money back. Secondly, it's the breakdown in the LRT, the mini rail system, Kuala Lumpur. This is their idea of Ministry of Transport among Malaysians. And the other one is Hanayo, you know, dealing with women's issues, children's issues, that sort of thing. So these are so-called less risky political posts that was given to the DAP. So I think the DAP has made the right decision in keeping a low profile now. I think they understand that the key to stabilities with Anwar's government is that, you know, their coalition with UMNO has to do very well in this upcoming six state elections. And that if the DAP is going to deliver anything to the non-Malay community, it will be over the long run. I think people keep forgetting that one of the reasons why the DAP was successful in Penang, right, over the last 15 years or more, was that most of the reforms only came after the first term, in other words, from the fifth year onwards. And I think the DAP has brought that lesson to the national level.
That's good. And Jahaba, we've seen ructions in UMNO. And do you think, leaving the six state elections aside, although we know that's going to be very influential, do you think AMNO will continue to support Anwar, in assuming that the elections go fairly well in the States.
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, one thing that's happening this weekend is the AMNO elections. Mm-hmm. Because the top two spots have been blocked, there's no contest rule. So the major focus will be on the vice presidency and of course the other positions in the party, the powerful Supreme Council. Zahid's team has got the youth chief post. They've got the women's chief post, and now the attention is whether his group will, or his faction will win the three very strong vice presidency seats this Saturday. So I think if he can keep control of his party for the next 3 years, that the Anwar government can withstand its full term, its full mandate. But having said that, because he's still president for the next 3 years, he can still keep that together. So, notwithstanding what happens at the state elections, that this government can last. But what's interesting is how the state elections go will actually inform us, the general public, the analysts, the critics, the soothsayers, the crystal ball gazers, as to how stable AMNO will be going forward. Because if they continue to weaken at the state level, and if PKR can't break out of their urban seats, then you're going to see this so-called green wave being stronger in the rich states of Penang and Selangor. And I like to point this out. Penang wanted to have their state elections on November 19th, but Anwar at a central level said no. They agreed no, they will have it later because they didn't want to get distracted with state elections. And this is why the state of Negeri Sembilan too hasn't had an election. And Selangor, these are the three so-called Pakatan states. But there's a danger in Penang now because it's a 40-seat state legislature. 19 seats on the island contested by the DAP. As James sort of, I wouldn't say a lavish praise of the DAP, but he did say that they did a good job in Penang. They have done quite well. But there's 21 seats, state seats, which are contested by PKR and Amanah, the Malay partners in Pakatan. Their seats are in danger, particularly on the mainland. And because someone like Nurul Izzah can lose a federal seat on the mainland, those 21 seats are in danger, in serious danger of being lost. Because all you need is 21 state seats in Penang Island, in Penang State, to form the government. Mm. Right. So there is a danger. There is a danger not just for AMNO, but there's a danger that Pakatan Harapan itself could face some losses unless they take the lessons of November 19 and start shoring up their machinery and getting, a younger set of candidates who are hungrier to stand for elections. So that's a danger there. This is not for AMNO, but I think for all the parties, there is a huge danger for them. On the flip side, Perikatan itself will have issues because Tan Sri Muhyiddin has been slapped with 7 charges, a few more cases, charges coming up. And I think the one lesson we can see from all this is that they can't flash the kind of money they flashed during the 15 general elections. They flash a lot of money. They flash a lot of flags. James and I had the opportunity to take James around for one campaign, which was DAP, which was fine. But I mean, I think he went around to a lot of places and he himself sort of assessed this money quotient that could sway the electorate to go the other way. So that's something to watch out for too, come July.
Great. We'll come back to domestic politics in the Q&A, but I have to put one question on foreign policy because of, our institute's focus on that, and it's also a very interesting one. We have seen in foreign policy, Anwar take, as we would have expected, given his internationalist mindset, and quite amazing network of friends, which has already been alluded to in high places around the world. He's taken a forward-leaning role. He was in the Philippines recently, and he quoted Jose Rizal as part of a pitch for ASEAN to do more in Myanmar. I quote him saying, "In all honesty, I believe that non-interference is not a license for indifference." This must be one of the highest profile challenges to one of the sacrosanct principles of ASEAN by a member head of government in my memory. James, how adventurous do you think Anwar is going to be, or is he going to be allowed to be as he handles foreign policy?
So I think foreign policy will not be his key priority, at least for the next 2 years. But I think he will take certain positions which will sort of reinforce his brand as what they call the Muslim Democrat. I think he's trying to enhance that brand as a Muslim Democrat. I think he does see himself at the end of the day as sort of the intellectual person who can merge democracy, Western-style liberal democracy with political Islam. Because as you know, right, one of the major things about the West is that a lot of people have argued that these two are incompatible. So he's one of those people who have been saying for the last 20 years, ever since the Asian Renaissance, that these two are compatible and you can sort of merge these two. So he will take certain key positions. So when I talk about that sort of thing, I'm talking about he will organize some very high-profile conferences. You can already see the people who were involved in this sort of this Islamic way of thinking about how international relations work. Some of these people left Malaysia when he was in prison. My understanding is some of these people have suddenly popped up in Kuala Lumpur and they're talking about organizing conferences again. So I think he will, have some platforms. I think he will work together with like-minded leaders trying to project a sort of a more positive image of Islam. And I think we can see that he'll be working closely with people like Erdogan in Turkey, who he's very close to, and maybe some of the more progressive groups in Indonesia, who he's also very close to. So I think that part he will do. But I think for the next 2 years, I think domestic thing will be his priority rather than foreign policy. It's interesting that you mentioned the case of Mama. I think for the Malaysian side, my take is that Malaysia has been talking about Mama even under the former regional Ismail Sabri and Muhyiddin. They've also talked about that we need to do more. Part of it is because of the Rohingya thing, the Muslim solidarity thing. But I think it's widely understood in ASEAN circles that Mama is a too hard basket. And I think the key to ASEAN, I mean, in terms of ASEAN thing, my take is that ASEAN is really a house divided now. And the reason why it's a house divided is all due to this great powers rivalry between the West and China over South China Sea and the rise of China. So I think that is a topic that I don't think Anwar will touch. And that topic is, of course, linked to what is happening in Myanmar because it's part of the what they call the great powers game. But I think on the Islamic platform thing about putting a more positive image of political Islam, I think that he would do, but it is not his priority.
Okay. And you alluded to Indonesia, Jahaba. One country where he has particular resonance is Indonesia. I watched his public address during his recent visit to Jakarta. I mean, the love in the room was quite palpable. And there were people eating off his words. Are we going to finally see the Tu Negara Serumpun from the same roots bring their diplomatic weight together? Is that an opportunity for Indonesia and Malaysia to work together in a way that they haven't in the past?
I think that definitely, for sure. I think, you know, Indonesia has always been always assumed to be the big brother. And when Anwar was sacked, a lot of his supporters had to flee to Indonesia. They have very deep, deep relationships there. As you said, you know, he can walk on water in Indonesia. That's really is what he is, right? And I think both between him and Jokowi, we'll put some pressure on ASEAN regarding Burma. But for them, for both to get together, there will be a lot of possibilities for future cooperation. I think they're going to get together on palm oil, on a host of issues. Malaysia will see benefit in exporting whatever engineers who are left in Malaysia to work on infra projects in Indonesia. Already, actually, there are some issues because Indonesia itself is on an expansion in Nusantara. We are losing a lot of, but we can't attract their workers to come to Malaysia. So I think then we'll have more investments in Indonesia going forward. And this is something which the trade minister, the economics minister will have to have a look at. If you see Anwar has always made it, he's more, a more Nusantaran kind of guy than, say, a reformist in that sense. Mm. So I think he will definitely work together in Indonesia on a host of issues. And in a way, sort of a pincer movement for Singapore to consider. We might see a revival, and this was Anwar's push when he was the Deputy Prime Minister, of the IMT, GT, the growth triangles will start again. You remember from the 90s, before he was sacked, both at the Borneo side and at the southern side with Bintan, Riau Islands. So you're going to see a revival of a lot of those projects coming up. And more so, I think, one, so as to give a sort of vision and hope to Malaysians. In many ways, to my mind, it's actually a Mahathir roadmap, which he is finally going to execute better than, say, anyone else had done. Because when he was sacked, this was the big thing. This was the main thing that was going on. You know, we had airlines that were servicing southern Philippines. And you have to remember, Philippines is very important to Anwar too. Southern Philippines with Sabah and Sarawak. So I think all this will just make it, we will have more emphasis in ASEAN. I think since the time of Najib, post Abdullah Badawi, and all the prime ministers since then, they sort of neglected ASEAN, and the Malaysian voice wasn't truly heard at the ASEAN corridors. And also, again, with say, neighboring states like Australia. But now, I think, in a sense that, because he has sort of an arrested development. He left at his prime when all these things were the buzzwords, right? Australia, yeah. Education, trade, and all that. So I think there are a lot of opportunities there at the regional and international level. Because Anwar, as James has put it, is a Muslim Democrat. And you know, he was once voted world's best finance minister, which, you know, you can take with a whole sack of salt. But there you go. I'm not a great fan of Anwar. I think he's okay for what he does. And I think at this late stage of his life, he has a lot to fulfill in the next 4 years than ever before.
Yeah. Great. I'm going to take some audience questions now. The first one, and it's a very good question. It came on the record very quickly. It's from an anonymous attendee. I'll read it out. There is a concerning trend witnessed in the general election, recent general election, GE15, where the Malay middle ground has moved further towards the right by voting for PAS mainly and Bersatu, secondly, while many of these were protest votes, the questioner asserts, against UMNO and Zahid. In the medium to long term, do you think this trend will continue to the point of being irreversible? I'll go to you, James. Is it irreversible, the green wave?
Yes, I think he's talking about the rise of political Islam. And unfortunately, the answer is yes, it is irreversible. So you can see this very clearly among the young people. And the reason for this is very clear, is due to the education system we have in Malaysia. And secondly, the growth of the private Islamic schools in Malaysia. So because of these two main factors, combined with sort of a government direct, indirect coercion through a government department called JAKIM. So all this means that it is irreversible. I think the worst case scenario is that Malaysia will end up something like Pakistan, where on the surface you have a modern political system. If you scratch the surface, it's all based on tribal, Islamic, and all that sort of thing. That will be the worst case scenario. The best scenario for Malaysia will probably be something closer to Indonesia, where there is an Islamic bloc, but that Islamic bloc can never capture power on its own.
Jahaba?
Yeah, I think I have to agree with James to a certain extent. Because when you talk, the question is very specific. You're talking about the Malays, right? Of course, Malaysia is much more than the Malays. Unfortunately, 70% of the population is officially Bumiputera, of which about 55-60% are Malays. And there are two groups of Malays. James was focusing on the younger set of Malays because of education. But there's also the older Malays. These were the ones who were educated, educated in the 70s and 80s. They sowed their wild oats everywhere. Some came back with Caucasian wives and husbands. But so as they go on in life, as they get older, they'll be inward looking. They are the ones who are sponsoring these religious schools. They get a bit more religious because, in the words of Dame Zainuddin, whom I had the opportunity of talking to middle of last year about all this, he said, you know, Malays, when they get older, they look towards God. They look towards death and they want a better afterlife. So for them, this kind of mindset will suggest it'll be PAS, it'll be Bersatu, it'll be a Malay nationalist Islamic group, very similar to Pakistan. So we will see this until these guys die off, probably around the same time I expire too. But you will see this trend going on for a while. May I ask Dame Zainuddin, how long would this last? And he said, at least 10 years, at least 2 to 3 election cycles. We just went through one. So maybe a decade from now, we will see a change. But he said, look, this is only natural because of the environment that we are in and what the country has encouraged from the 70s and 80s and 90s. We are reaping what we sowed, you know, this focus on Islam, Islamic education, setting up a national Islamic department. People intrinsically link the fact, oh, I'm Muslim, I'm not corrupt, you know, I pray 5 times a day. But as you can see, and we didn't discuss this, all the guys who went to court in the last 2 weeks, and this is one of the questions being asked, are all Malay Muslims, right? These are the chaps from Bersatu. They were in government. They are Malay Muslims. They were charged with corruption, and they were charged with soliciting money from Chinese businessmen and all that. Najib Razak is a Malay. He was charged with money laundering and all that. Zaid Hamidi, all of them. So it's a very interesting conundrum we're in. The Malays, the electorate believe they're electing clean, pious leaders. But these are the guys who are in court now. So whether they'll be turned off, I don't know.
And I think that the second question is a good segue to continue a little bit to dig deeper. And the question goes about the role of young Malaysians and what role they will take in Malaysian politics and decision making. So I'll turn that around and link it to the first question. Is it so, Jahaba, you're suggesting that there could be some factors that this cycle could ride itself out with maybe the younger generation, notwithstanding a block of them have been, for want of a better word, been in this bubble of religious schools and whatnot, maybe with the influence, and Malaysia is a very connected country on the internet. Still, I go back there and you know, the level of English, notwithstanding, you know, people of my father's generation sort of complaining about it, I'm always surprised at the literacy and the connection to the world that even some of the religious people have. Do you think there's a chance that after these cycles that you could have a more centrist outcome, for want of a better word?
I'm not optimistic because in relation to what you just said, the government just announced a clearer set of rules for entertainment, for concerts and all. They've expanded the number of days you can have concerts, and all kinds of concerts, but they've also said, okay, you can't have cross-dressers, every script has to be approved, you're filming a movie in Malaysia. So to my mind, that is the politicians whom we consider liberal pandering to the civil service or interest groups in the country. But that also just tells you that Malaysia today is a set of many Malaysians. the urban Malaysians, whether they are Malay, Chinese, Indians, who study together in private schools and are very cosmopolitan in their outlook, very internationalist, and a bit, for want of a better word, very liberal with how things are. But you also have a growing number of Malaysians outside the urban areas who might have some resentment because they feel they're entitled, because they are sons of the soil. Unlike their parents who are poor farmers and who toiled the land or caught fish in the sea, these guys are just playing with their handphones the entire day. And with the rise of social media apps and such, they are being influenced by religious nutters, so to speak, the likes of Zakir Naik and all. They spend the whole day just imbibing this. And you know, this is just not unique to Malaysia. You've seen this in America. It happened in New Zealand, right? They're listening to or following conspiracy theories, QAnon and all that. So this is not just an Islamic thing. This is a global phenomenon, especially among the youth. So when you say, what's the role of the young? I can't say, because what influences the young today isn't like when you and I were much younger, not when we were in 17 or 18. If you were a Penangite or what, you'd listen to the RAAF radio from Butterworth, right? So you, if you grew up there, you would listen to Elvis Presley, you listen to a lot of punk bands because you could tune into that station. But today, if you were in Malaysia, you don't know what your child is watching or listening to, because they all have a handphone. They all have a data plan. You can't say what, you won't know what they're going through, right? So, and the Muslims themselves are worried, because they say, hey, hang, some of them are becoming Shiite Muslims, right? We can't have that too. So the young mind is fertile for any kind of indoctrination. And it's something which no one has studied, no one has seen. What we know is this is happening more among the Malay youth than the girls, because I think 70% of undergrads in Malaysia are women. So they're more stable and they're a bit, I'll say, easier to, a bit more stable in their outlook of politics too. And so that's a pushback, especially during Women's Day and all that. But the young males, they are the ones that are so part of the so-called Green Wave. They're the ones who voted because of the change in law where automatic registration, including getting to vote at the age of 18, meant that anyone who was lazy to even register now was a voter. And some of them were paid, they went to vote. And that's why we have a fair number of so-called Green Wave MPs in our country. I can't say the young are the future. I don't know, because it depends who's influencing them. And none of us have done enough study or gone to all these remote areas to see what moves them. Is it religion? Is it punk rock? I don't know. I have no idea.
James, can you be a bit more optimistic?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. Let me just bring into another angle about what Yahaba and I have just said about the rise of political Islam in Peninsula Malaysia. I think there's another picture brewing, and that picture is brewing in East Malaysia, in Sabah and Sarawak. I think the picture over there is sort of completely different. I'll just start off with Sabah. I think what you have in Sabah is that increasingly you see the rise of Sabah nationalism, and the Sabahan politicians are looking towards Sarawak. And this is where the Sarawak picture is a really interesting picture. So I think for the last 10 to 15 years, the Sarawakians basically don't like what is happening among the political class or politics in Peninsula Malaysia. So they have decided among themselves, among the political elites in Sarawak, sort of to close the borders in Sarawak. So they're trying to build a state within a state. So that's the reason why if you go to Sarawak today, right, Sarawak is the only state that allows people to hold demonstration to ask for independence, complete autonomy, all that sort of thing. And the incredible thing is that the last time they held a demonstration asking for independence, they did it in Central Padang, which is just opposite the police station. Now, I can guarantee you, if you were to hold such a demonstration in any other state in Malaysia, you'll immediately be arrested for sedition. So you can see that the Sarawakians are very, very specific about building a state within a state. And you can also see this by the fact that the Sarawakians have played this card so successfully that no West Malaysian party other than the DAP has been able to create a foothold in Sarawak politics. Even for the DAP, I would argue that it's due to local factors rather than federal factors that would account for DAP having a foothold in Sarawak. So that's what the Sabahans are trying to do as well. They're trying to build a Sabah for Sabahans, and the Sarawakians are well on their way in terms of building a Sarawak for Sarawakians. So I think it's really interesting. As I mentioned earlier, we have a really interesting vision for Malaysia. The sort of Malaysian polity is divided into three separate visions. The first vision is the past vision, the biggest bloc in parliament. They want a more theocratic, more Malay state, what I call Ketuanan Melayu Islam state. Then you have the DAP state who want Malaysia to be modern, secular, liberal. And then you have the East Malaysians who are saying that you guys on the peninsula have lost the plot. You know, you're spending too much time playing with Islam as a government thing, right? So we want to do our own thing. We want to look back at a time when we had our own unique history. You know, we were conned by the British to join this thing called Malaysia. You promised us autonomy. In fact, you didn't give us autonomy. Now is the time now that you're weak over there. You're completely politically divided. We want to raise this issue of Malaysia agreement, and we want to take back political power to do our own thing. So there's sort of a, you know, this type of three visions happening in Malaysia at the same time. And for me, right, on the one hand, it's really good because I believe in a plural political system. On the other hand, knowing the Malaysian political system quite well, I can also argue this is also quite a dangerous trend. So really, we really need Anwar to use all his political talent, so to speak, to pull everybody together. But I'm sure Johaba will agree with me. Unfortunately, we don't know what is his vision for Malaysia until after the state elections.
Thank you. There was a third question, and I think it's a good one to focus on because it's very, very kind of hot off the news. How likely is, and it comes from Christian Wells from our audience, how likely is that the corruption charges against Muhyiddin Yassin are politically motivated, as he has recently claimed? What effect will this case have on relationships within the governing coalition? Maybe I'll start with you, James, and then go to Johaba.
Okay. So the way it works in Malaysia, right, for high-profile political cases, everything is political. To say that it's not political is not true. The question is that how political it is. And I think that remains to be seen. As to the sort of whether it will affect the Anwar government, the answer is no, it will not affect the Anwar government, other than the fact that in these upcoming state elections, Bersatu Muhyiddin's party and Perikatan can't claim to be any cleaner than UMNO. You have to understand within the Malay dynamics, right? Muhyiddin's party is really a party that is supposed to take over UMNO because they claim that they are the clean UMNO. In terms of Muhyiddin's party, right, the DNA for Bersatu is exactly the same DNA as UMNO. There's no difference between them, other than the fact that the Bersatu leaders have said that we are not involved in corruption. Zahid Najib, they call them the cock cluster. So that's the reason why in Malaysia now they're talking about the second cock cluster. The second cock cluster refers to the Bersatu politicians who are charged for corruption. So other than that dynamic, I don't see them sort of affecting the larger Pakatan Harapan government.
Johaba?
Well, yeah, I think, James said everything is political because they claim it's political. What would be interesting is if, when the cases actually start, I think Bersatu Perikatan PAS will use it as election fodder, political fodder when they go campaigning to say it's persecution. As the same thing that Zahid and Najib had said when the Mahathir Mohamad government did the same thing. But it'll be the man in the street that will have to decide, the voter will have to decide. Were they affected by whatever that was happened during the lockdown when all this perceived corruption was happening? Was this government really clean? Is Muhyiddin as clean as he says to be, or is he being persecuted? I think the government of the day has been very smart in not sacking the people who are prosecuting Muhyiddin Yassin now. It's the same attorney general. It's the same anti-corruption chief. It's the same police chief. So you can't, you, these are the people you appointed. And this is the argument. These are the chaps you appointed, right? Now they are going after you. You can't say we are interfering. Because if these were, because every appointment is politicized, it's political, you, now you can't say that these guys turned against you or I made them turn against you. So it'd be very interesting to see how this plays on. But I agree with James here that the man in the street, the voter now, will have to decide whether this second court cluster is as corrupt as the first court cluster. And if you look at the amounts of money being discussed or being paid and all that, some are small amounts, some are huge amounts. But it's striking that it's being done in March, about 3.5 months before the state elections are being held. It's very quick. I mean, within 100 days, this government within 100 days went after people we thought they'd never go after. So it will continue to fester. Next week, we are going into the fasting month, where Muslims are not supposed to smear each other or talk politics. But it'll be a major topic of discussion for the iftar sessions after breaking a fast throughout the night. And I think both sides will have to come out with their strategies to basically explain themselves, right? Particularly among the Malays, particularly in the 6 states which are having elections. But it won't affect Anwar's government, and James is right, because the government is made up of different parties, except for one of them who was the finance minister when Muhyiddin and Ismail Sabri were prime ministers. And I think this gentleman, Tengku Zafrul, has enough savvy. I mean, this guy's an unelected guy. He lost the state in the general elections, right? I think he has enough political savvy and acumen to basically not to be thrown under the bus and then turn it back on these chaps and see them at least have a foot in jail rather than, you know, I have no idea whether they will be convicted. But I think, like Najib, will take some time. But I think the Anwar government, because of all this, will have an easier time, at least for the next 1 year, to coast on this and then do the hard work of trudging along to win, to do enough so that Malaysia will vote them into power in the next general elections in 2027. Yeah, that's what I think will happen.
My last question before we wrap up, and it's a bit of a nerdy question. It's something that I've focused as a former observer in the Anwar, the first Anwar Ibrahim trial. The judicial system in Malaysia, it's taken a battering since 1988. Is that, you know, do you have some hope that it will be reversed? It can be brought back from the brink, so to speak? Very quickly, James, and then Jahaba.
So if you speak to senior lawyers in Kuala Lumpur, most people will say that under this new Chief Justice, things have become a lot better, especially after Najib was found guilty and the appeal was done in 1 day. So I think a lot of people are quite happy with the way the judiciary is moving along. The problem is that 2 or 3 years from now, there will be a new Chief Justice appointed. And unfortunately, I was made to understand that the pool is very, very limited. So I think things are going quite well now. But with the Malaysian judicial system, everything unfortunately depends on 2 persons. One is the Chief Justice, the other the President of the Court of Appeal. If you get the right people in these 2 key positions, then everything will be fine. If you don't, then there'll be question marks.
Jahaba?
Well, I think, you know, the judiciary has sort of cleaned itself off from all of what has happened from 1988 and the time when Anwar was jailed and all that. But what is important is going forward, we have a good set of judges now. They're very independent at the top level, at the levels of High Court, Court of Appeal, Federal Court, right? What will be interesting is that before the last general election, the Prime Minister of the day, Ismail Sabri, had sort of changed the composition of the Judicial Appointment Commission. This is the commission that advises the Prime Minister. So then this goes back to the Prime Minister, and then to the Conference of Rulers on who will get promoted and at the senior post. In many ways, it's a bit like what Trump has done in America, where you put in conservatives, people aligned to a certain viewpoint, in positions where they could choose the next batch of judges. So it'll be interesting to see what Anwar will do in the next few years. Also interesting that maybe this power shouldn't be given to the Prime Minister. It should be given to Parliament. And this is things which we will have a robust discussion in the next few years in Malaysia. But there are some people in the Appointment Commission who are very conservative. So while the current batch of judges are independent and I wouldn't say conservative with their views on how things are run in the country or cases before them, we will go through a time where there will be a set of judges who will be a lot more conservative than the current batch. And then we might then again revisit this idea whether the Malaysian judiciary has restored itself to its former glory. Because there'll always be two, three points to points to this view. I don't know. But I can tell you that this is something we have to look at, something that Parliament has to look at, something that politicians will have to say, look, you know, you want this country to prosper and be better, there must be things that should be institutionalized and should be reformed. Now, whether they have the appetite to do that, I have no idea. But I would say that what happened in America is happening in Malaysia. So there will be a tide of conservatism in our country going forward.
Yeah. Thank you. We've just passed the hour and a half mark. I would like to wrap this up by first saying thank you very much to both our expert speakers, James and Jahaba. It's been a very rich discussion and exchange. We've had this been planning for a while. I'm happy we were able to do it a bit later than what we initially planned. But with the country of festivals that Malaysia is between Christmas and Chinese New Year, and we managed to snuck it in between Chinese New Year and the fasting month. So I'm glad we were able to do that. I'd love the opportunity to come back and talk to you again, you know, maybe in a year's time after the elections or the state elections and things have settled down, and see what does Anwar's administration look like a year on in. Personally, I've had a very fun and interesting and rich opportunity here tonight to tease out some issues. Our audience has been, you know, we've had more than our usual number of webinar audience. And I see some familiar names there, so welcome and thank you. And please look out for the YouTube video, which we hope to be able to produce before too long, and you can distribute to a wider audience. Any final words, James and Jahaba?
James?
Okay. So, no final words. I think last November's results, although we didn't come up with a clear winner, I think the government put in place was the correct government for today's Malaysia.
Thank you, James. Jahaba?
Well, all I can say is that I'm sure I'll see James when the six state elections happen. I'm Malaysian first. I'm always, whether I'm a journalist or not, I'm always a Malaysian. I like to think that this government is the right government at this point in time. It is a coalition government. It's a government that will probably reflect 80% of my aspirations for this country. I am just minded to think that, as I mentioned before, there's this conservatism wave in our country. I can understand why it's happening in the area, the rural areas. I can see the fear that everything will change, that they've been spooked by many things happening in the last 50 years in our country and by a lot of political charlatans posing as leaders. I hope that with more interaction, more conversations like this, not just at a regional level, but within Malaysia, that we can actually get that Malaysia that Tunku Abdul Rahman thought about and did in 1963. I think that Malaysia is everybody's dream and sort of is still eluding us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James and Jahaba. And thank you to the producer, Ash Jones, who's been in the background helping us set up, our secretary, Oliver, and the whole committee from AIIA, WA, and also our sister organization, AIIA Tasmania. Thank you for all your support and hope to speak to you all soon. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
Thank you.